everybody. Thank you very much for being here today. It's lovely to see you. I want to take a moment to say thank you to all of the folks who organized our amazing auction. The online auction happened between August the 1st and 10th, and we have raised several thousand dollars for the KTC from this. And so thank you, thank you, thank you to all the people who purchased things and so forth. And then also thanks to the people who organized it and ran it and like watched it and did all those things. I mean, you would not believe how many things go into an auction on eBay. Oh my goodness. It's a culture. It's a thing, you know. So at any rate, I really want to say thank you for that, because this was the first time we tried something like this, and for it to be successful has been very nice. It's very nice. So anyway, special thanks to Justin and to Kashmira and Chris and all the people who worked on the auction. Yay. Yeah, it's like, woohoo! It's like, thank you very much. Slowly, you know, people ask, well, how are you going to rebuild your center? And it's like one brick at a time. We're just going to keep collecting the money until we get one brick at a time until we get it all finished. So that's how projects like this get done, just one little bit at a time. And so everybody gets to help. And I'm sure that during the announcements today, you heard that we're going to have the film fundraiser this Wednesday evening. So if you want to come down to Gateway Film Center, 7 o'clock, come early. We're going to do a film on, it's called Yangtze. It's a film that has not been shown in the United States. And the only reason we can show it is because I know the director. It's a documentary about a young man who is a Tibetan reincarnate lama, or tulku, and how he is discovered and how he makes his way in the modern world. And so it's a feature-length documentary, and you'll enjoy hearing about his story and seeing that his story and our story as we attempt to become spiritual people are really not that different. So at any rate, that's this coming Wednesday. And then in September, we'll be doing the Commanding Your Life fundraiser workshop with Stephen Hayes, the martial arts teacher. So we've got lots going on and more to come, as they say. But today, I was going to continue my talk on mantra practice. Because those of you who are familiar with our center and the name of our center know that karma takes some choling. Our name denotes, it actually tells our story. The name actually tells our story. Karma refers to the head of our lineage, which is the Karmapa, whose picture is on the shrine. The Karmapa has been the main teacher of our lineage for 1,000 years, just about. And so we are of the Karmapa's lineage. So that's our family name. Family name comes first. Second is Teksum, which means three vehicles or three paths. And it refers to the three paths of Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana Buddhism. Three levels of teaching that we participate in as we begin our Buddhist practice, deepen our Buddhist practice, and then deepen our Buddhist practice even more. So you could say that everybody starts out as a practitioner of the Hinayana, or the path of individual liberation from suffering, and that most of us begin our path of meditation because we are experiencing a need for quiet and comfort and solace in our life. And so we start meditating to help ourselves first. And then slowly, gradually, as we become more acquainted with the practices of meditation and we get some of that peace and solace and comfort for ourselves, we begin to look around and recognize there are other people also suffering in this world. And that gives birth to compassion and the bodhisattva commitment to benefit others. The bodhisattva path, bodhi means awakening, sattva means a person who holds that mind of awakening. The bodhisattva path of wishing to liberate others is called the maha, or greater, vehicle. It's called greater not because it's better. It's called greater because it is larger in scope. Hinayana, the smaller vehicle, is about our own liberation from suffering. And the Mahayana is how we liberate others. How do we liberate others? Through love and compassion. And so the practices of love and compassion are also taught here. Meditation, the Hinayana, is taught here. Mahayana is also taught here, these practices of love and compassion. And then finally, the Vajrayana. Vajrayana, Vajra means indestructible. Yana means path. So the Vajrayana is the indestructible path. Or you could call it the path of the indestructible. And it, when we say it that way, the path of the indestructible, what is indestructible? Our Buddha nature, our potential to awaken, is natural within us and cannot be destroyed. It cannot be displaced. It cannot be destroyed. Our Buddha nature is within us always and will never be taken away from us. But how do we relate to our Buddha nature? Hearing about it can be very encouraging. Although I've actually met some people who, when they first heard a teacher say, "You have the potential to be Buddha," they get a little scared. They say, "Buddha? Me? Do I have to do it now? Can I wait? Am I up to it? Is it all right?" And the answer to all of those questions is, yes, it's all right. Yes, you can do it. And yes, you can take your time. So the practice of the Vajrayana, then, are the methods for nurturing our Buddha nature, developing it, and manifesting it for the benefit of others. And so we build on the previous two yanas when we practice Vajrayana. We don't just practice the Vajrayana without doing the first two. We have to practice some quiet sitting and get hold of our mental afflictions, or we won't be able to develop love and compassion because our mental afflictions will always be getting in the way of our love and compassion, as we have seen this week. So, meditation, getting hold of our mind, is first. Practicing compassion for ourselves and others is second. And then, based on those two, we can begin to take hold of the practices of the Vajrayana, which include practices of the path of liberation and the path of skillful means. The Vajrayana has two paths. Sometimes I feel like a flight attendant. There are two exits over the wings, you know. The path of liberation is deep, penetrating insight meditation, sometimes called vipassana, sometimes called laktong, that's its Tibetan name, sometimes called mahamudra meditation, this deep penetrating insight meditation that shows us the nature of our mind as Buddha directly. But then the path of skillful means is the path of mantra and yogic discipline. We'll save yogic discipline for another day, and we'll talk about mantra today. Mantra, as we explained last week, one of the meanings of the word mantra is a protection for the mind. Our body, speech, and mind right now are often very busily occupied by doing lots of negative things. We have a lot of bad habits. I know I meet a lot of people who say, "Man, I have so many bad habits, I don't know what to do with them all." The idea is that because we generally use our body, speech, and mind for bad habits and things that harm ourselves and harm others, then we have to train our body, speech, and mind to do beneficial things, to good habits for ourselves and good habits for others. The very best good habit we could take on is the habit of meditation. The next good habit we can take on is the habit of training our mind in love and compassion for others. Yes, we have to train to have compassion for others, because while we might have a little bit of natural compassion for the people we think of as being part of our family or our tribe or our whatever, our community, there are other people who are outside of the fence of our community, and we see them as being other or different. And those are the people we have trouble having compassion for. You remember me telling the story of the chaplaincy student who came to me and said, I have a problem. There is a group of people I cannot have compassion for. And I said, oh, that sounds really difficult. Oh, who is it? And she said, anybody I disagree with politically. All of those people on the other side of politics for me, I cannot have compassion for them because they're wrong and they're bad and they're evil. And I said, okay, now we have something to work on. Now we have something to work on. So there are always going to be people who are outside the fence of our love and compassion. And these are people we could potentially harm. These are people we could potentially harm. We like to think of ourselves as being peaceful people. But why do you think that Mahatma Gandhi, and why do you think that Martin Luther King trained his followers to not react violently when they were verbally and physically attacked? Why did these two amazing beings teach nonviolence? Why did they teach nonviolence? Because they knew that if oppressors made us angry, then we would be the same. We would be the same. We would become oppressors ourselves. So this is why nonviolence was trained in. And they had to train. They had to actually sit and rehearse being in the presence of people speaking to them hatefully. They had to practice it. They had to pretend to be hateful to one another as they practiced how not to react. So it's something we have to train in. It's something that doesn't come naturally. And so that's why in the Buddhist teaching, we train in love and train in compassion, particularly for those who we feel distant from or maybe even feel negatively toward. You remember when we taught the practice of Tonglen, compassion meditation, some weeks ago. The practice is very simple. You breathe out and imagine you give goodness to others. And then you breathe in and imagine you remove the pain and suffering that makes them the way they are. And we breathe out and give goodness to others and breathe in and remove their suffering. And we do this with our imagination, because in our imagination, we can do anything. In our imagination, we can do anything, because our minds are limitless and clear and have Buddha nature. We can imagine anything. We can even imagine a love that is as wide as the world. And we can imagine having that. And we can imagine giving that. So, this is why the second practice is this practice of love and compassion. And in the practice of mantra, we take that imagination a little step further, in that we remember our Buddha nature and imagine our Buddha nature in the form of a Buddha or Bodhisattva. We imagine our Buddha nature fully blossomed and developed. I mean, when I look in the mirror these days, I do not see a Buddha. I see the gray hair and the wrinkles and all of those things, but I don't necessarily see a Buddha. But when I practice mantra, I imagine I am a Buddha, and that my body is made of light. My speech is empty like an echo, but resounds with the sound of mantra, such as the compassion mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. And thought is no longer the chatter of, I like this, I don't like that. I want this, I don't want that. The chatter, I set that aside and think, may all beings be happy and be free from suffering. The idea is that I act as if I am an enlightened being for just a very short amount of time. I don't have to do it forever. I just have to do it for the period of time that I'm meditating. And if I can do it for that 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes that I'm meditating, imagine that I have the body of a Buddha, the speech of a Buddha, and the mind of a Buddha. If I can imagine it, then slowly that part of me that is Buddha will grow and flourish just a little bit. It will get a little larger each time. When a person goes to the gym to train their body, which is something I don't know much about, I keep hoping someday I will be able to train my body, but it doesn't seem to work out. When people go to the gym to train their bodies, they don't start out picking up the biggest weight that they could possibly pick. They start out with small ones, small weights, and do just a few repetitions of the weight movement. And then slowly they work up to bigger weights and bigger weights and bigger weights until they can lift more. And so it's the same with compassion, and it's the same with imagining our Buddha nature. It's going to be a little bit difficult at first. I have people tell me, when I try to visualize myself as the Bodhisattva of compassion, I have trouble doing that because my imagination is not strong enough to see all of Chenrezig, the Bodhisattva of compassion. I can see his face, but then I lose his legs. And if I see his legs, I lose his face. And then if I see one arm, I miss the others. And is this okay? They always ask me the same thing. Is it okay for it to be imperfect? And the answer is absolutely, absolutely fine for it to be wavering, incomplete, and imperfect, because that's how we are. We are wavering, we are imperfect, and we come and go and inconsistent. So our imagination will get stronger, just like our weightlifting arms will get stronger, our imagination will get stronger. It takes days, weeks, months, yes, even years for this kind of strength, even though it's imaginary strength, to get there, but we'll do it. And then what do we do once we have imagined ourselves as a Buddha or Bodhisattva? We imagine that all beings become just like us. Yes, even the people we dislike, we imagine them to be Buddhas and Bodhisattvas too. Because every being has Buddha nature. Even the people who do evil things, even the people who do wrong, have Buddha nature. It's buried, and in some cases it's buried really deep. And in some cases it's buried so deeply under coarse, even malevolent habits that they may not even be aware of its presence. But it's still there. And so we can imagine even negative people as having Buddha nature and looking like a Buddha. It definitely is not going to hurt them, and it could help. I mean, how would it be if we imagined that all of the politicians in Washington and everywhere else were in the form of Chenrezig or Tara or the medicine Buddha? We imagine them all to be made of light and perfect in every way, full of love and compassion for others. We may not think, our intellect may tell us it's not possible for this to change anybody, but you would be surprised. You would be surprised. I remember having a quarrel with someone. This was years ago. And all I could do, I was so angry at them, all I could do was imagine they were a Buddha. Over and over and over again. It was so difficult because they had harmed me and were mean to me, and I didn't like them, and all I would do, and I'd think of them as all the things they did wrong to me, and I was very unpleasant about it in my own mind. So I figured I had to use some strong medicine on my resentment, because my resentment was not hurting them. My resentment was poisoning me. So I decided to take the strong medicine of imagining them as a Buddha. It was a little difficult at first. Why should I do that? They've been so wrong. They've done this, they've done that. But I gave it up And I said, okay, just for the few minutes of this meditation, I'll imagine them to be a Buddha. And I'll have the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas rain down white light upon them, removing and washing away all of their negativity, removing and washing away all their malevolent habits and negativity and so forth. Well, the bad news is that it didn't change the person, not one bit. But what it did change was my resentment. My resentment became smaller. And as my resentment got smaller, I became less, shall we say, preoccupied. I became less preoccupied with their faults. I don't know about you, but sometimes when I find fault with something, I think about it a lot. I was talking with someone this morning and we used the word stew. It's like you're stewing in it, you know? Like vegetables stewing for a long time, they start to disintegrate. You know, I'm just stewing in my negative feelings, you know? But the idea here is that if we can change that even just a little bit, just put some light into it, then we feel better. And like I say, it won't change them, but it will change us. However, in this situation, it worked. I don't even know how to explain it. But the person said to me, oh, you know, that thing I did, I'm so sorry for that thing I did. Out of nowhere. This was, of course, more than 2 years after I got angry at them. I carried that grudge for a long time. But maybe 2 years later, they said, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for that thing I did. Now, your mileage may vary. Your experience will not be the same as my experience. So we can't expect that meditation on mantra will magically change other people. But it definitely cannot hurt them. It definitely cannot hurt them. And it has the potential to open their minds to something amazing. So, this is why we teach mantra meditation at our center. This is why we're doing a mantra retreat in 2 weekends from now. I think it's the weekend of the, is it 24, 25? Can you remember the dates? I think it's something like that. We're going to go out to Saints Peter and Paul. And yeah, we're going to do a Buddhist retreat at the Catholic Retreat Center. I can't wait. We've been out there before. We used to do our spring and fall retreats out there. But we're going to go out there and we're going to start at 6 a.m. on the Saturday. And we're going to do a longer form of the Chenrezig practice with lots of the compassion mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. We're going to do a lot of that. Saturday morning, then have a big lunch. Then starting after lunch on Saturday, there'll be a fast. People will be fasting from food until evening. And then they'll be fasting also from drink for the next day on the Sunday. Now, some people say, why do you do that? That sounds really uncomfortable. And because we don't break that fast till Monday morning, like at, 6 or 7 a.m. And they say, why would you do that? And the answer is we do this so that we become aware of the suffering of other beings. It's very easy to sit comfortably in our house and think, oh, I have everything I need. Everything's good here. Oh, too bad about those others that don't have enough. But what if you actually were hungry? What if you actually were thirsty? What if you actually were tired but had to keep going? What if you actually couldn't speak to express how you feel to someone else? Because that's what the Sunday is like. You don't speak, you don't eat, you don't drink. So you artificially, for this period of time, Sunday from Saturday night till Monday morning, artificially place yourself in the position of so many others who cannot eat, cannot drink, and cannot even speak to express how they feel. And when doing this, we say prayers and mantra, even though we don't speak usual thoughts, usual words. We say the words of the mantra and the practice. We do that all day Sunday. We get tired. We get thirsty. We get hungry. We get miserable. Some people sleep a lot. Some people can't sleep at all. And they feel uncomfortable for a full day and a half. But actually, it's a day and a few hours. And they say, why? Why do that? Because how else will we become aware? Once we become aware of the suffering of others, we are more convinced than ever that we have to help them. More convinced than ever that we want to rescue them and benefit them and not hate them, even from afar. So this is the function of it. There's another function, too, which is that by causing ourselves a small amount of discomfort, we use our imagination to aspire and hope that we and all beings are free from this kind of suffering now and in the future. In other words, we imagine that we take on the negative consequences and the suffering and the hunger and the thirst of all beings. We imagine, use our imagination to take it on and say, may we be bodhisattvas and benefit all beings, and may all beings be purified from the negativities that bring about suffering. And that's the function of the Nyungne fast and retreat. Become aware of the suffering of others and imagine that we purify the suffering of ourselves and others. So this was what I wanted to talk about today, was to talk about how to pick up from last week, where we explained what mantra is and how we do it, to this week, to talking about Buddha nature and how we clear away all of the negativities through the practice of mantra, and then begin to manifest that goodness to others. Now, I could go on and try to put all of these things together. I'll say just a few more words and then we'll have a discussion, because I think discussion is fun, and ask questions back and forth about this. But there's a couple more things I'd like to say about mantra practice. Mantra practice is, for many people, it's the first time they're able to do what is called shamatha, or calm abiding meditation. Some people like to do the breath awareness meditation of shamatha. They are where they're aware of the breath going out and coming in and going out and coming in, and they bring their attention back when your attention wanders. This shamatha promotes calm abiding in the mind. But some people, it's difficult for them to rest their attention on the breath. It's not easy. They can't do it. But if you ask them to visualize themselves as a Buddha and recite a mantra, they can do that. And so for some people, this is the only way they can practice shamatha, is through mantra and visualization. And for other people, it's the only way that they can really engender feelings of compassion for others, because they can imagine engendering compassion for others and do it that way first. So for a lot of people, mantra practice is in some ways a game changer for their spiritual practice. It allows them to actually practice. A few years ago, I was a participant in the brain studies at Princeton University, Columbia University, and the University of Wisconsin at Madison. I never got to meet Dr. Richard Davidson, who is the famous researcher at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, but I met some of his assistants, and I worked with a Theravadin practitioner at the Princeton study, who was just a man named Brent Fields, who was just a wonderful fellow. And Brent asked me a difficult question. He said, I've been interviewing a lot of Tibetan meditators, because you guys do that three-year retreat thing, where you go and you're in meditation retreat for 3 years. You guys do that. So I've interviewed a lot of meditators from that group. But I have to ask you a question. Where are the Tibetan quiet sitting shamatha practitioners? I don't see them. Where are they? I don't hear about Tibetan meditators spending hours in quiet sitting in a cave somewhere. I don't hear about that. Why don't I hear about that? What's up with that? And I said, let me get back to you. So I went and I asked Kempo Carter Rinpoche. You know, he's in his 90s now, right? You know, so he knows everything about there is about Tibetan Buddhism. So I said to him, I said, okay, so Rinpoche, the Theravadan practitioner wants to know where are our meditators, the ones that sit for hours in silence and quiet meditation. He said, oh, he said, yes, no problem. He said, they're all doing mantra. They're all sitting in caves for hour after hour after hour, and they're doing mantra meditation. They're doing shamatha with a pure form object. See, when you get into the textbooks and start reading about shamatha and vipassana, shamatha is subdivided into lots of forms. Shamatha with an object, shamatha without an object. Okay, so let's go to the form object. Okay, so there's the pure form object, which is a Buddha or a Bodhisattva image. There's the impure object, which is a stick or a stone. And then there is another form of that, which is an imagined Buddha, is a form of shamatha. You imagine a Buddha image, and that's your object of shamatha. So there are lots of ways of doing form meditation in shamatha. There's also formless meditation in shamatha. The most famous instruction of formless shamatha is the one from Tilopa. Don't prolong the past. Don't invite the future. Don't analyze the present. Instead, rest in the present moment of mind's natural awareness. That's the most famous meditation instruction, but it's not easy to do. So that's why they support short periods of that style of meditation with long periods of form meditation on visualized objects. So I was relieved to find out that I had an answer for the researcher, that they were actually doing their shamatha through mantra practice. And it made me feel better because I had been doing mantra practice for 3 straight years and wondered about that. So where do we end up? Where we end up is back with our name. Karma takes some choling. What are we doing in this congregation? What are we doing in this community? We're providing, in this community, we're providing a community, a congregation, atmosphere of support that embraces practitioners who want to practice these 3 styles of meditation. For shamatha people, we teach shamatha. For Mahayana people who want to learn compassion meditation, we teach compassion meditation. For people who connect through mantra, we teach mantra practice. We have these 3 forms of meditation at our disposal to help people learn how to incorporate conscious living in their everyday life, how to live consciously and live with compassion, integrity, and wisdom. So that's what we're doing. And this is why I wanted to talk about mantra, because mantra for some people seems to be very esoteric, possibly weird. As my mother used to call it, it's that woo-woo stuff. I love my mom. I really miss her, I'll tell you. But at any rate, she used to call it that way because she thought it was a little strange, you know. But it's okay. Believe it or not, we've been using our imagination since we were very small. It's not something weird or different. It really isn't. I mean, I used to pretend to be Mary Poppins. I didn't have to visualize anything. I had a costume. Made it myself. Had a hat, had an umbrella, had a long dress. I was Mary Poppins. I made believe that I was a magical person who could fly. Thank goodness I didn't jump with the umbrella. But the idea was there was a strength in that imaginary play. As I played and imagined myself as this transcendently magical person, my regular life became different. And it was important to me. So, Anyway, if we can use that imaginary play that we used as children and bring about inner peace that will help us to manifest outer peace, this is a very powerful thing indeed. It's something worth thinking about. So anyway, I could go on and on, but I best stop here. But this gives us some time for questions. And then at the end, we'll do what we did last week, which is recite the Chenrezig mantra 3 times together as a group. So anyway, does anybody have questions or curiosities? You can ask about the lecture today or last week, or ask any question that comes to your mind, because I'm open to discussing anything. It's been a big week, so people might have questions about everything, anything. Question microphone is over there. If not, we'll go. Okay, here we have a question. All right. Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, can we help her with, he'll help you. You know, there's a way to do it.
And I'd just like to say that Randy Newman said he wrote that song, Short People, to make fun of people making fun of short people. He wasn't actually making fun of short people. I read that recently on the internet, so it has to be true.
I'm very happy for that. I'm a big Randy Newman fan.
I'm very happy for that as a short person. So I'd just like you to repeat that quote. I think you said it was from Tulopa. Don't prolong the past. And that's where I...
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. Yeah. The instruction... There's actually more to the instructions of Tulopa than that. There's more. Like, you know, don't try to make things up. So there's all kinds of, it's really long, but I only remember those first lines. Don't prolong the past. Don't invite the future. Don't analyze the present. Rather, rest in the present moment of mind's natural awareness. Not an easy thing to do, you know. We're used to trying to make something out of meditation, to try to, you know, create some kind of artificial thing and call that meditation, but that's not what meditation is. It's about being able to rest like that. Most people can do it for just like a few seconds. And the easiest way to do it is to not do it. I don't know, has anybody heard of this young meditation master, Mingyur Rinpoche? Just a few? Okay. Mingyur Rinpoche shocked the world. He was like a rock star. He had like thousands of people coming to his lectures and so forth. And then he decided that he wanted to do something different. He wanted to do what his father had always wanted to do but was never able to do, which was run away from home and meditate in the wilderness, in caves, all by himself for years. So he was gone for 4 years. He actually went and did it. And when he came back, he's well processed, very well processed. But he still teaches the same way, which delights me. He says, oh, you want to practice meditation? Great. Okay, everybody, don't meditate. And he says, how was that? And everybody says, well, that was easy. And he said, great, now we're going to build on that. So how he did that was that what he means is that when we don't try to do anything and we just let our mind be, we can only do that for extremely short periods of time, 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, because then we get antsy and want something to happen, you know? But those few moments, those few seconds, give us a clue as to what this type of meditation is like. And then slowly we learn methods to actually cultivate it. We can't just not meditate forever. We have to come up with methods and techniques. But he gives people confidence that they can meditate. He says, he leads people by saying, okay, who thinks that they have awareness? And then he has people put up their hands. Who thinks that they don't have awareness? He says, okay, good. You all have awareness. You either have it or you are aware you don't have it. So you have it. And he uses this humor. He uses this method of humor to help people understand that meditation doesn't have to be difficult. So anyway, so I could go on about him because I'm a huge fan, but we'll just let that be for now. Anybody else have a question or something they're curious about? I have a cookie. No? Okay, yeah, sure. Because we can meditate if there's no questions.
Maybe I might have missed this at the beginning. And it's more just a personal curiosity that I should go research. But I guess just wondering about the history or origin of mantra practice. Like did the Buddha do that and talk about that? Or mm-hmm. did it become part of like a later
right.
tradition?
Or, sure.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My knowledge of it is not as broad as it would be if I were like a real Buddhist scholar, because I'm just a sort of an amateur scholar. But my understanding is that there are sets of Buddhist literature called the sutras, which were actually spoken by the Buddha in specific places. And then there are the tantras, which were spoken by the Buddha in different places. And often the tantras were spoken by the Buddha taking the form of a specific bodhisattva or Buddha. So, for example, and that's where he taught mantra. He taught mantra there. Although in the Mahayana sutras, there's the famous mantra that he taught in that was actually taught by Chenrezig, the bodhisattva of compassion, in the Heart Sutra. If you remember... When the Buddha was on Vulture Peak and he was resting in a meditative absorption, Shariputra and Avalokiteshvara, or Chenrezig, were there with him, along with a huge company of arhats and bodhisattvas. And Shariputra, while the Buddha was meditating, was inspired to ask Chenrezig, well, how should a son or daughter of noble family train in the perfection of wisdom? And Chenrezig started speaking the Heart Sutra, basically, and then the Buddha afterward arose from his meditation saying, it is just as you have said. Near the end, I mean, at the beginning of the Heart Sutra, Chenrezig is saying, emptiness is form, form is emptiness, there is no other emptiness than form, there is no other form than emptiness, which is a way of speaking about the ultimate nature of all things, that all things are not solid, real, permanent, and unchanging, but rather are impermanent and always changing. And that in that way they are empty of permanence, but yet they appear, and yet they have form. So, that's very deep, and not everybody can grasp that. So at the very end he said, thus, it is known as this is the mantra, the ultimate mantra that shall be known as true because there is no deception. Meaning this mantra crystallizes the entire sutra in a mantra. Teyata om gate gate para gate para samgate bodhisoha, which has the meaning of gone, 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 beyond, beyond the beyond, hail the one who goes. And so then when the Buddha arises from his meditation, he says to Chenrezig, it is just as you have said. So it becomes one of the sutras that the Buddha did not personally speak, but endorsed. And so that, to my mind, is one of the first places I have heard of a mantra being included in a sutra, but there are others. But in the tantras, he speaks about the creation of sacred outlook through the creation of the idea of mandala. Each of us, the word mandala means center and surrounding. Center and surrounding. It's usually depicted as a square, like a palace with doorways. And in three, when they're shown in three dimensions, they're shown as palaces, and inside there are Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. It's like a pure realm. And that the Buddha of the practice is in the center. Like if this were Chenrezi practice, we would imagine ourselves as Chenrezi in the center of this amazing palace. Well, what's interesting is that we have a daily life, an everyday life. When we get up from practice, we're still the center of it. And we still have a surrounding. We have our environment, our home, our workplace, our family, our friends, all of the people who are in this mandala with us. And if we can do practice and transform ourselves, then our world becomes transformed as well. Maybe not to their experience, but definitely to ours. Although I would say anybody who's ever been in the presence of great masters, such as Mingyur Rinpoche, such as Karmapa, such as Dalai Lama, such as they feel something when they're in their presence because they're in the presence of this great awakened mind. So we can transform our own mandala of mundane things into a mandala that is sacred. Does that make sense? Okay, yeah. I kind of went sideways on that. I hope that was, yeah. Okay. There's time for another one. Is there another question? Okay. Then we'll practice. Many people have said to me this week, it's been a hard week for some folks. And they have said that they have not felt safe because of all of the threats going on in the world. They have perhaps from their own lives felt unhappy in their past and maybe gone through some frightening and scary things in their life in the past. And hearing about all of the negative speech going on between world leaders right now, it's made them feel the same way they felt when they were younger and unsafe. So I've been advising a lot of people this week to recite mantra because it really can sometimes be the only thing that can replace the worry in your mind. You just put something different on because we have the churning of this might happen and that might happen and this could happen and this bad thing could happen just over and over. It becomes worry and agitation. And so I'd like to do a short Chenrezig mantra meditation right now and hope that this will be of some help. And definitely, it definitely won't hurt, but it could help. So I'd like to invite everybody to consider for a moment that they would like to be of benefit to others in this world, especially those who are in danger and those who don't feel safe. And they would like to offer a blessing to those who cause harm, making the aspiration that those who cause harm will be pacified, their hatred will be pacified, their negativity will be averted and turned away. And so I would like to encourage everyone for just the next few moments to imagine that they are in a pure realm where everything is made of light. The environment is beautiful, like a park. There's soft grass, trees that sway in the breeze, and sunlight. There's a feeling of gentleness everywhere. We imagine that where we are sitting There's a lotus flower. It's made of light. And on top of that is a flat disk of the moon, shining white, bright light. And on top of that is ourselves in the form of Chenrezig. He is a white bodhisattva, having both male and female characteristics, wearing a skirt made of red silk and a blouse of white cotton worked in gold. Chenrezig is wearing a crown with five jewels, symbolizing overcoming the five negative mental afflictions of anger and jealousy and all the rest. Chenrezig has a smiling face, and exudes light of the five colors, but mainly white light, like an incandescent light bulb shows light in all directions. We imagine that this light reaches the pure realm of Chenrezig, and that he comes and is above our heads and dissolves into us and blesses us. Then we imagine that Chenrezig blesses all beings and they all become Chenrezig. And now we'll recite the Chenrezig mantra three times through the melody, making the aspiration that all negative beings are transformed into Chenrezig, and that they will give up all negative actions.
Om mani padme hum. 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 Om mani padme hum.
We imagine that the world is the pure realm, dissolves into all beings as Chenrezig. All beings as Chenrezig dissolve into light and merge with the Chenrezig that rests above our head. The Chenrezig above our head dissolves into light and merges with us, blessing us. And then we as Chenrezig dissolve into light from the top to the middle and the bottom to the middle to a small dot of white light and then into emptiness. Arising again in the form of Chenrezig, We imagine that we have a body made of light with two arms, and one is holding a rosary and the other a lotus flower. And we think that we dedicate the goodness of this session of practice to all suffering beings, that they may be free from suffering and come to happiness and then to Buddhahood. And coming to Buddhahood, may they emanate in all directions and benefit sentient beings endlessly. We mentally dedicate the goodness with this thought in mind. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. If this is helpful, there's a different form of this practice online on lamakathy.net, and you can look it up. It's called Chenrezig for Beginners. Writing is on one side, the chanting is on one side in English and in Tibetan, and then the description of the visualization, which is modified from what we talked about today, is on the other side. So if this is helpful to you this week and in the coming weeks, take advantage of this, which is based on the 15th Karmapa's teaching. So I want to thank you and wish you well. And am I here next week? Yes, I'm here next week. Okay. So if anybody has questions that they didn't feel comfortable asking in person, you can come up and see me after. So it's like, thank you, thank you, thank you, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Soundman.
Okay, thank you.